This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Good day. This is Chris Blazewski with the New York Times, The Athletic sports section for Sunday, May the 19th, 2024, here on WRRS Radio Reading Service. And this new version of the New York Times sports section, which is now completely provided by The Athletic, has several articles featuring all kinds of sports. We'll start off with college softball. College softball thrives in the shadows. Has its moment in the sun arrived? Exposure, popularity, and stars. It's college softball on the brink of a breakthrough. On a steamy Thursday afternoon at Stanford Smith Family Stadium, every Cardinal player and coach not on the field stands against the dugout rail, shouting encouragement at someone, including, between every pitch, a chorus of, "Yeah, Nija." Nija is a Stanford pitcher. Nijeri Kanadi, a 6-foot sophomore who finds herself in a bind against rival Cal. She began the top of the fifth inning with a walk, a pass ball, and a single. Now the Bears have executed a double steal to pull within 4-2. There are no outs and a runner at second. It's a 2-2 count. But on her 89th pitch of the afternoon, Kennedy unleashes a searing rise ball to strike out leadoff batter Lagi Quiroga swinging. Kennedy smiles and exchanges an excited clap with shortstop River Mahler. And then in an instant, the inning is over, with Kennedy notching another strikeout and a 2-pitch groundout in the eventual Pac-12 tournament win. With the NCAA tournament opening this week, college softball has steadily increased in popularity over the past decade. Viewership for the Women's College World Series Finals reached a record 1.85 million viewers in 2021, and notably passed the men's CWS championship with 1.6 million viewers in 2022. The WCWS has reached at least 1 million viewers in each of its last four seasons. It did not air in 2020, and some believe the sport may be on the verge of a women's basketball-like breakout. A handful of recent stars, Alabama's Montana Fouts, Oklahoma's Jocelyn Alo, Tennessee's Kiki Molloy, have captivated audiences over those 10 days in Oklahoma City. Still, the last softball player to transcend into the mainstream sports world was arguably Arizona pitcher Jenny Finch more than 20 years ago. Kennedy, a Topeka, Kansas native and star pitcher with 256 strikeouts in 168 innings and a .5 ERA, could be that generational player. Nijeri, extremely competitive. I think she might be the face of college softball right now for that reason, said Reese Atwood, the top hitter for number one Texas, who in February slammed one of 5 home runs hit against Kennedy this season. She's one of those standout players that just everyone knows her name in the game. Kennedy burst on the national scene as a freshman at last year's WCWS, where she struck out Oklahoma star Tiara Jennings on consecutive at-bats, unleashing her now familiar fist bump and howl after both. "I feel like I show my emotion a lot on the mound," said Kennedy, "especially if it's a good battle." She then closed out a 2-0 upset of Alabama, threw a 1-hit shutout with 9 strikeouts against Washington, and helped the Cardinal take the number one seed Sooners to extra innings before falling to the eventual champs a second time. Now, a year later, as the 8th-seeded Cardinal begin their quest to return to Oklahoma City, members of the softball community mention Kennedy alongside the all-time greats. In particular, because of her rare ability to combine velocity, she was clocked at 75 miles an hour in last year's WCWS, with sorcery, her rise ball, a pitch with backspin that appears headed to the strike bone only to rise as it breaks, is virtually unhittable. I honestly don't know if I've ever seen a rise ball like hers in my whole life, said Stanford pitching coach Tori Nyberg, a Cardinal pitcher in the early 2000s. Monica Abbott is in a class of her own, but in terms of the velocity, she's the only person I can think to compare to hers. Abbott, a four-time All-American at Tennessee from 2004-07, an NCAA career strikeout leader, holds the Guinness World Record for fastest softball pitch at 77 miles an hour. She predicts Kennedy will break it. Nija is already throwing as fast as I was as a pro, said Abbott, now an ESPN analyst. Her limit does not exist. I think she could potentially reach 80 miles per hour. I don't know. Can Nija be the Caitlin Clark of softball? I kind of believe she can. Limited professional opportunities mean most players stay for their full eligibility, adding to the competitiveness and making them more recognizable as their college careers progress. Among the stars, there's Oklahoma's Jennings, a top 10 player of the year finalist, who is quietly climbing to the top of Oklahoma and WCWS record books. There's Nebraska's Jordy Ball, the former Oklahoma ace who missed this season with an injury but holds high expectations when she returns next year, and Tennessee's Carolyn Pickens, who joined Abbott this year as the second Lady Vol to be named SEC Pitcher of the Year. There's two-way powerhouse Valerie Cagle, the reigning player of the year who helped put Clemson on the map. I thought I could come in and accomplish all these goals and no one would care. Now looking back, I understand it's very unrealistic, said Cagle, who set a school record in hits, 83, while pitching with a 1.56 ERA last season. That's so cool to me that people recognize softball and are excited about it. And then there's Kennedy, whose impact goes beyond the mound. Natasha Watley, a four-time first-team All-American at UCLA and two-time Olympian who runs a foundation dedicated to diversity in softball, said Kennedy is inspiring the next generation. I have a young daughter now. To see a black pitcher at Stanford University, that's normal. That wasn't the norm for me, Watley said. I don't know if she realizes how powerful it is. Kennedy said she noticed early on the lack of diversity in the sport. Only 6% of college softball players are black, according to NCAA data. But that was something that helped me want it even more. A two-time state champion and Kansas Gatorade Player of the Year, Kennedy grew up playing numerous sports alongside her brother BJ, now a freshman defensive lineman at Cal. In the second grade, she briefly played offensive line. She was a four-star basketball recruit in high school before focusing on softball as a senior. Her hitting coach growing up told her she could go off to college and be all-conference in basketball, said her father, Bruce Kennedy, but if she sticks with softball, they will talk about her for a long, long time. That talk began last summer in Oklahoma City and will only intensify if Kennedy and the Cardinal make another run over the next 3 weeks. Becerra, who has called many of Kennedy's games, marvels at this moment for both the pitcher and the sport. Somehow she's gotten even better since last year, Becerra said. No one's really sure how that's possible. But that's what generational talent does. Next story featured is headlined 10 years after winning the Boston Marathon, she finally received her prize money. 2014 Boston Marathon winner finally receives prize money from a stranger. We cried. 10 years and 1 month after Buzudesh Deba finishes the rightful winner of the 2014 Boston Marathon, she was finally given the prize money she never received. But it didn't come from the Boston Athletic Association. Rather, it came from a stranger. When Deborah crossed the finish line on Boylston Street in 2014, she didn't receive the international praise, the ceremonial gold wreath, or the purse of $100,000. $75,000 for winning, plus $25,000 for breaking the course record. Rather, those honors and winnings went to Rita Jeptu, who crossed the finish line first that year, but whose victory was stripped by the BAA in 2016 after a failed drug test. Deba finished just over 1 minute behind Jeptu for second place that day, but her time of 2:19:59 still shattered the previous chord record set by Margaret Okeo in 2002. But while Deba's name replaced Chiptune's in the history books after the failed test, the money never appeared in Deba's bank account. Despite Chiptune's record being scrubbed and her name being tarnished, her winnings have never been reclaimed. Similar cases have unfolded with the Chicago Marathon, where Lilia Sherbukova won the race three times for a total of $265,000 before she was caught doping. Like with Chiptune, no money has ever been recovered from Sherbukova. That is until Doug Guyer, who gave her the money out of his own pocket. Guyer, a businessman from Philadelphia, personally paid Deba her $75,000 after reading an article in the Wall Street Journal in April about her never receiving her winnings. "We cried. I called my mother to tell her, and she was so happy," Deba told The Athletic in an email. Deba, who has competed internationally for Ethiopia, is based in the Bronx, New York, with her husband and two children. She found success at the 2014 New York City Marathon, where she finished ninth, and returned to Boston in 2015, where she finished third. But for Deba, that 2014 win remains the pinnacle of her career, and for her family, those winnings were sorely needed. "It means so much. It allows me to train again. We don't have a sponsor. We have to pay for everything," she said, "and I have two children. The money will go to my training and my family. We are so grateful. We have waited so long for this and almost gave up. God bless Mr. Doug." Guyer, who played football at Boston College and was beaten out for the starting quarterback spot by Doug Flutie in 1981, told the Boston Globe, "It was just about righting a wrong that's been wrong for 10 years. Guyer said he'll consider sending the $25,000 course record bonus if the BAA doesn't. The BAA said in a statement is in pursuit of reclaiming prize money awards from Rita Chiptune and plans to pay Deba her winnings when the association receives them. The organization said it is backed by policies held by World Athletics and supported by World Marathon Majors. The BAA is still pursuing Ms. Chiptune to recover the prize money from Ms. Deba, which the BAA believes would be a just and fair result for her and all runners who follow the rules, BAA spokesperson said. Deba said she was skeptical of Chiptune's performance from the day of the 2014 race, saying she wondered why Chiptune wasn't tired when she crossed the finish line. But when Deba was told in 2 seconds that she was the winner, she couldn't believe it. "I was in my apartment and I jumped up and down. It was my biggest win," she said. "Not only was I the champion, but I was also the course record holder." Despite her decade of waiting for a proper winning, Deba said she's never held bitterness against the BAA. Instead, she considers the organization like family. While she took her story public in April, in the weeks before the 10-year anniversary of her win, she held back from sharing it for so many years because she trusted the BAA would do right by her. She also feared that if she said something, she would not be invited back to the prestigious race. "This started when my friend came to my apartment and looked at my second-place trophy and asked, 'What's this? Where's your real trophy?' I told her that they never sent one to me," Deba said. "She was so upset for me. We wrote to them, and I eventually got my medals. Then they asked me to come to a celebration for the 10-year winners. She told me that I should see what they planned to do about the money." In response to the Wall Street Journal story, fans from around the world came to Deba's defense, with many willing to crowdfund her winnings. "I am so grateful to know that so many people are behind me," Deba said. "It is important that people know how hard I work to win. This is my job. I was not begging for something that wasn't mine. A lot went into winning, and I am glad to see that the community agrees with me." It wasn't until after the April article was published that the BAA responded about trying to move her case forward, Deba said. And yet, that doesn't diminish her adoration for the race or even deter her from wanting to return to the world's most famous marathon. "It is still my dream to come back and not only run, but win in Boston," she said. Next featured article, the winners and losers of the NFL schedule reveal. NFL schedule 2024 winners and losers. Caleb Williams has a chance to thrive. Jets face treacherous slate. We're near halfway between the conclusion of the NFL's 2023 season and the dawn of its next season. And now finally, teams and their fan bases can appropriately prepare for the upcoming slate. while teams have known their opponents for quite some time, now they can handle the logistical preparations for the 2024 season. Not all schedules are created equal, of course, and no, this has nothing to do with the formula to determine opponents with these unbalanced schedules. The process is just dandy. Glance through the quirks of each team's schedule and anyone can find, and even some friendly bounces. That's where we come in, as we run through some of the winners and losers from the 2024 NFL schedule reveal. Winners, Chicago Bears. The Bears are gearing up for their most anticipated season in decades with the arrival of quarterback Caleb Williams and wide receiver Romeo Ndunze to headline their exciting offseason. Those big-ticket personnel moves came on the heels of an impressive 5-3 finish to the season that drew the attention of front offices around the league. More reason for optimism, the Bears have the third easiest strength of schedule, 0.467, based on their opponents' records in 2023. Also, the winners are the Atlanta Falcons. The Falcons and the Saints are tied for the easiest strength of schedule in 2024, based on their opponents' records from last season. While this could just be an NFC South thing, the four divisional foes rank in the top six in strength of schedule ease, the Falcons are the team with the shiny new quarterback. Veteran Kirk Cousins is expected to boost a team that is coming off three consecutive 7-10 records, and the league has backed Atlanta's excitement with four primetime games. Other winners, Dallas Cowboys. It won't be hard to find the Cowboys on TV. They're tied with the 49ers and Jets with a league-high six primetime games as they're scheduled to face the Giants, Steelers, Niners, Texans, Bengals, and Bucks after dark. They've also got five games in that marquee 4:25 p.m. Eastern time slot that tends to draw a heavy spotlight. And let's throw in a Thanksgiving matinee against the Giants to top it off. The Cowboys only have four 1 p.m. kickoffs, plus the to-be-determined start time in the finale against Washington. The Week 14 bye week draw. Somehow six teams have the last bye of the season, which is tied with Week 12 for the most byes on a given week. The Patriots, Ravens, Texans, Colts, Broncos, and Commanders will get a welcome chance to rest in early December. On the flip side, it may be wise to avoid stocking up on fantasy players from those teams in case you've got a must-win matchup in the regular season finale. Taylor Swift's favorite team. The two-time defending champs enter the season with five primetime games, but it's hardly be a shock to see the Chiefs get flexed into an extra window before it's all done. Sure, the Chiefs have a tough opening pair of games against the Ravens and Bengals, but they're both at home. And after raising the Super Bowl banner and then losing to the Lions last season, Chiefs coach Andy Reid shouldn't have a problem getting his team's attention. The Chiefs also take on the NFC South, so they caught a break with that one. Losers, New York Jets. The Jets' Achilles heel in 2024 may be their early season schedule. Too soon? Six of their first 11 games are in primetime, which will work to their benefit if they get off to a hot start and send a message to the rest of the league. But if things go south, the Jets have seen when they're overcome with negative attention. And remember, primetime games come with wonky scheduling quirks, including a Monday-Sunday stretch with the Bills and Steelers and a Sunday-Thursday string with the Patriots and Texans from Week 6-9. They open with three games in 11 days, including road trips against the 49ers and Titans before opening at home against the Patriots. Although, again, since many teams have daunting stretches in a short spurt, it's an advantage to get it out of the way at the start of the season when they're theoretically healthier and better rested. But for those obstacles to turn into the advantages, the Jets are going to have to answer some early season tests. The Bills, Browns, Bears, and Vikings each have the unenviable task of playing three road games in 3 weeks. The Bills' stretch happens from weeks 4 to 6 against the Ravens, Texans, and Jets. Compounding the issue, they also visit the Dolphins in week 2. That's a date that always draws an eye roll from the Dolphins' AFC East foes due to the heat. The Browns' stretch also goes from weeks 4 to 6 against the Raiders, Commanders, and Eagles. The Bears will have a pivotal swing from weeks 13 to 15 when they visit the Lions, 49ers, and Vikings. For a team with real playoff hopes, the Bears are going to need to survive that series of hurdles. Another bye week quirk. As if the 49ers' schedule wasn't challenging enough, they'll play the Bills, Chiefs, Cowboys, and Seahawks, all coming off their byes. The Colts will play three teams coming off their byes, Dolphins, Titans, and Broncos, but Indy will be coming off its own bye for the Denver game. Four teams will play two opponents coming off their byes without the benefit of coming off a bye week themselves. Those were the Dolphins, Commanders, Saints, and Seahawks. 12 teams won't play anyone coming off a bye. Bills, Patriots, Jets, Ravens, Bengals, Jaguars, Titans, Eagles, Vikings, Packers, Panthers, and Falcons. So, hey, good for them. Old school remote controls. The NFL has more streamers than a Dunder Mifflin party. With games now streaming on every platform short of your nephew's YouTube channel, viewers of a certain age will surely roll their eyes when it comes to determine which platform is carrying any given national game. Or even if you're technologically savvy, you'll still need a moment to mentally prepare if you're planning to flip between channels during commercials. The future is here, and we'll embrace it appropriately, but it's a slower crawl for some. Turning to background Major League Baseball, headline, a massive media decision could be in MLB's future. Could MLB nationalize its media rights? Why, some clubs are pushing to end local TV deals. 60 years ago, Baseball Commissioner Ford Frick received a telegram from a Wisconsin congressman, Representative Henry Royce, was worried the Milwaukee Braves would defect to Atlanta for the promise of a richer television contract and proposed a fix. If all the Major League Baseball teams would share their television money, then the Braves might stay. According to the Associated Press, Frick replied in that summer of 1964 that a plan to pull all television receipts would not be feasible or acceptable at this time, but would be worthy of future consideration. Now in 2024, that conversation has arrived. Commissioner Rob Manfred and some of the sports owners are more seriously talking about nationalizing baseball's TV rights than ever before. Not because of relocation, but because of cord cutting, the failure of some traditional regional sports networks, and the simultaneous battle for streaming supremacy waged by Netflix, Amazon, and other streamers that has left sports leagues and rights holders in a chaotic reformation. Some baseball owners and executives, mostly in smaller markets, believe the best way to grow media revenues over the long haul is to centralize the deal-making and from there to potentially sell all 30 teams' regular season broadcasts as one streaming package. Others in the game, particularly those whose teams make the most money, are vehemently opposed to surrendering their power over their rights. The hurdles to such a change are massive, but that is even being contemplated is remarkable. The end of local media rights in baseball would be one of the most radical alterations imaginable in the tumultuous world of sports television. Unsurprisingly, the possibility is also controversial. As the local media situation evolves, we will continue to evaluate the best model for us moving forward, Manfred said in a statement to The Athletic. Our course of action will be determined by the clubs, who are the ultimate decision makers under our Constitution. While MLB has long arranged various national media deals, including for the postseason, with networks such as Fox and TBS, and for Sunday night games during the regular season with ESPN, individual teams have always controlled most of their regular season inventory, as well as the choice of television stations they partner with inside their home markets. The central office already controls each team's out-of-market rights, which is why fans in New York can sign up for MLB TV and watch any game besides the Mets or Yankees. Doing away with local rights and could eliminate many of the blackout restrictions that frustrate fans. But not all clubs believe Manfred's office could utilize the rights better than they do individually. The most divisive matter, though, is the dollars. Regardless of how a commissioner deployed the rights, the question would be, how is the revenue distributed? By equal split or otherwise? The New York Yankees received an estimated $143 million as a rights fee in 2022, much greater than a team like the Colorado Rockies, which received $57 million that same year, according to Forbes. It is ultimately then a rekindling of baseball's classic drama, big market versus small. Everything is on the table for the future because it's so unknown, Sam Kennedy, president of the big market Boston Red Sox, said during spring training. Look, there's always the issues that come up where large market teams have a different view than the small market teams. In the end, the greater good of the industry is what we have to focus on. A new era is just beginning in sports broadcasting, and the changes are happening quickly. On Wednesday, Netflix and the NFL announced that the streamer would newly carry Christmas Day games. Netflix is paying in the neighborhood of $75 million per game. The heart of the discussion, then, is really whether baseball could thrive as a national sport. Ironically, the national pastime is often regarded as a local game. Like almost everything in American life, it's all about money, former baseball commissioner Vincent said in a phone interview. The money is so enormously tilted locally. You know, trying to get yourself, if you're living in New York, interested in a game where Seattle is flying to San Diego or something, it just doesn't work. Elmi just sold a package of Sunday morning games to Roku, which The Athletic reported Thursday was for $10 million per year. Previously, Peacock had paid $30 million per season for the same package. Roku, unlike Peacock, does not require a paid subscription, but MLB's lessened fee was nonetheless discouraging to some officials. One sport has long thrived on a national rights model, the National Football League. At the time that Frick made his comments in 1964, the NFL was already negotiating deals as one entity. But the sports were in different places then as they are now. The once-a-week NFL schedule has always delivered a much smaller number of games compared to baseball's nightly cadence. The league also might have to negotiate changes with the players' union because revenue sharing between teams is collectively bargained. A three-quarters vote typically allows the owners to modify the sports constitution, but support anywhere short of 100% for a shift in the right setup could leave MLB in perilous territory. If any owner felt the league was improperly assuming something of value, lawsuits could fly. In a nuanced distinction, MLB could launch some sort of smaller national streaming package, one with perhaps half the teams. Asked in February if the idea of moving away from local rights would have been unthinkable just a few years ago, Kennedy said, "The world is changing fast. Consumers need to have the ability to access our product, our games, whenever they want, wherever they want, quickly," Kennedy said. "We can't make it difficult." And that'll do it for today's New York Times The Athletic Sports Sunday. My name is Chris Blazewski, and I wish you a very good day.